Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects by Fidelity Investments Canada, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. Today, we're talking about opportunities in international growth. This is an interesting time for investing internationally as economies find themselves in different stages of reopening. Portfolio manager Jed Weiss, who manages Fidelity International Growth Fund for Canadian investors, joins host Pamela Ritchie to break down the last year and share where he is currently finding opportunities. Jed, who has also spent time solely focusing on emerging markets, is starting to find opportunities in India, noting valuations have improved. He says that emerging markets investing can be compelling as the dynamics of specific countries are different, but EM countries tend to be looked at grouped together. Today, Jed also dives into semiconductors, digital payments, and the electric vehicle market. He has been with Fidelity since 1997 and will also share his sell philosophy. This podcast was recorded on April 8th, 2021. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
Hello, and welcome to Fidelity Connects. I'm Pamela Ritchie. Global equity markets continue to reach new highs as worldwide vaccination efforts gain momentum. With supportive fiscal and monetary policies remaining in place, many believe the pace of global economic recovery will accelerate and extend the runway for equities. So considering this, how should investors approach the markets for the remainder of this year? And on a regional front, are equities outside of the U.S. positioned to outperform? Joining us to help us through answering all of these questions is Jed Weiss. Jed is portfolio manager of the Fidelity International Growth Fund. Great to see you again, Jed. How are you?
Oh, nice to see you, Pamela. Thanks so much for your time. Doing well. Yeah. Thank you.
So, Jed, I think we should begin a little bit with not just around the world tour, which you'll take us on to an extent, but a bit of a tour through the last year and how different things are for you in positioning and the way that you're investing now versus a year ago.
Well, it's certainly been a whirlwind year. And first and foremost, I hope everyone who's listening in is their families and themselves are safe and healthy. I mean, this is not, these kinds of humanitarian crisis is certainly not anything that anyone looks forward to. And I couldn't, as a citizen of the world, I look forward to things improving as quickly as possible. I will say this kind of market dislocation has presented a lot of equity level opportunities. And so that's what I'll talk about in response to your question. You know, if I think back a year ago, the market was really in complete disarray. The types of opportunities that I was looking for at that time were trying to find where is the market inefficiency. And the market inefficiency there was not what everyone was focused on, which is when are we going to get back on an airplane, but it was more on businesses that have robust fundamentals, almost irrespective of how the COVID crisis evolved, and yet their stocks were down a lot. So to take one extreme example, elevator servicing companies, you know, elevators are a very consolidated global oligopoly. The vast majority of their profits come from legally mandated servicing of existing elevators. That's not going to change. You can go into the office, you can not go into the office, you can be using your building, you're not using your building, but you still got to service your elevator. And yet these stocks were significantly dislocated. You know, industrial gases is another example. Very stable business, severely dislocated stocks. That was where the inefficiency lay. If I think more in the last 6 to 9 months, the biggest inefficiency is in companies where their competitive positioning coming out of this crisis is going to be notably stronger than when it went in. And in some cases, that does delve into severely impacted industries. So for example, in travel software, travel booking software for tickets, you know, when you get on an airplane, that's a pretty consolidated market. It was a three-player market going in, but two of those players are severely indebted and may not necessarily come out the other side. So you could have a three-player market becoming a one-player market or maybe a two-player market. At the very least, there's one player that I think will steal a lot of market share in this process. Those are the types of opportunities I'm looking for. And you know, there's a lot of sectors like that. If you think about commercial catering, for example, of course, that's been severely impacted. You know, people aren't going to sporting events, et cetera. There's been a tremendous amount of consolidation within that sector as a result of this, favoring a few large players at the expense of a long tail of small players as digitalization matters more, delivery matters more, food scale matters more, being able to track the food supply chain matters more. And I think by and large, the bulk of this market is going to come back. People are going to go to sporting events again. People are going to go to concerts again. People are going to go to university again. Yes, there will be a segment of the white collar employment that may not come back, but that's actually a pretty small percentage of the total commercial catering market. So those are the types of opportunities I'm finding, because by and large, I think the market has increasingly done a pretty good job of just baking in a straight cyclical recovery, but not such a good job in differentiating companies whose cross-cycle earnings will be notably stronger.
You know, it's interesting to sort of have you help us understand largely what you're sketching there is kind of a reopening trade on some level. But of course, you're looking internationally for this. And I mean, it's interesting. We've talked a lot actually on Fidelity Connects about the emerging markets, about different pockets of international, even about frontier markets sometimes.
Sure.
Can you help us understand sort of whether that fits with what you're doing in terms of those terms or whether it doesn't?
Well, certainly emerging markets are an important part of what I do. And actually, if you go back in time, I used to work specifically on emerging markets fund back in early 04 to early 07. So I have some direct experience there. And of course, the fund, since it was launched almost 15 years ago, has actively invested in emerging markets. I think one challenge is that emerging markets is often viewed as one brush. Actually, the dynamics at the country level are often completely different. It's a category that encompasses, you know, China and Brazil and South Africa and Turkey and, you know, a lot of disparate countries with very different fundamentals. So yes, the fund invests in emerging markets. Yes, I'm able to find great opportunities there. I would say, you know, I've been relatively intrigued by opportunities within India, where that market has underperformed the last couple of years. Actually, there's been some good economic reforms that have happened there. So valuations have improved, and yet the underlying fundamentals through COVID crisis basis have gotten better. Chinese tech, you know, I remember 15 years ago when I was looking at some of the, you know, at China, it was often, well, let's find the Chinese version of Facebook. But actually now a lot of these technology companies are innovating much faster than their Western counterparts. So there's some exciting areas there. So there's a lot of interesting opportunities within emerging markets, but then there's other countries where very different dynamics. So you really have to be careful on what you're looking at.
And just so everyone understands, is it entirely ex-US or are there some nuances within that?
The fund's mandate is international, which is ex-US, but you'll notice that the fund actually does own some US-based securities. But if you peel the onion there, the vast majority of those holdings are companies with a significant majority of their revenues and profits overseas, aka these are international names masquerading in some ways as US securities. And you know, one example that the fund has owned historically has been PriceSmart, which is essentially the Costco of Central America and Colombia, literally founded by the same family that founded the predecessor to Costco. So it's exactly the same model. You know, 99% of their business, 99.7 or something percent of their assets are overseas in emerging markets. So it's really an emerging market play, but the family likes San Diego. You know, I've had lunch a couple times with the chairman and his favorite fish restaurant in San Diego. So there's always going to be a little office there, but it's really an emerging market security. So when you see my US holdings, they're not all as extreme as the PriceSmart example I gave you, but the general theme of these are really international stocks that are based in the US. And I'll contrast that, you know, there's some international stocks that are really US, you know, they're considered international, but actually they're really US holdings. You know, if you think of James Hardie in Australia, it's really a US housing play, even though it comes up as Australia. So I'm less focused on country of domicile. I'm more focused on where's the economic exposure. And in that sense, this fund is very much an internationally oriented fund.
Is it too early to comment on the discussion about sort of global corporate taxes, which has clearly been thrown into the spotlight by Janet Yellen recently? Is that one day going to change an investment thesis, or is it just sort of a big conversation at a very high level?
Yeah, it's certainly something I'm watching out, and the Fidelity research team as a whole is doing a lot of work here. The proposals I've seen so far, I guess I'm not overly concerned about the global implications thus far. There are some company-specific dynamics that we're keeping track of. It's also important to keep in mind that, you know, the Democratic congressional majority is a very narrow one. Some of the headlines that you see may not become reality. So it's something I'm watching, but when I think of how I'm allocating my time and where I'm seeing the most opportunities, I wouldn't say that global taxes is the biggest thing on my mind, because there is a certain amount of wait and see, and there can often be a big disconnect between headline and reality.
Yeah, completely. And anyway, so it's just an interesting headline, but kind of out there. Let's talk a little bit more about bucket opportunities, how you put them into different categories. We can sort of go into the themes from there as well. But I am curious how you sort of approach, find bigger positions, your process.
So my sweet spot for investment are multi-year structural growth stories, high barriers to entry businesses at attractive valuations based on my earnings forecasts. You know, and there's a couple key takeaways from that. You know, one, this is not a growth at any price fund. You know, valuation is an important part of my process, but it's valuation based on my forecasts. Two, I tend to run a low turnover fund. You know, this fund historically has kind of 20 to 25% turnover, although you'll note that in times of extreme market volatility, like we saw last year, that turnover goes up as I'm trying to capitalize on opportunities. But I spend a lot of time on the pricing power, the competitive barriers of a business, which to me, a truth serum for that is pricing power. And it's pricing power at every point in the cycle. Meaning there's lots of businesses that when times are good can raise price more or less in line with inflation. But there's very few businesses when times are terrible that are able to maintain or even raise their price. And this matters a lot because when times are bad, they may not be cutting prices, but you can be sure that those businesses are cutting their cost structure. And if you cut your cost structure, you maintain your price. When demand does come back, you'll benefit from higher cycle to cycle margins and returns. And I'm optimistic that, you know, a number of the fund's holdings that may become clear as the economy rebounds. But all the caveats apply. Past performance no guarantee of future returns. And, you know, that's sort of how I go about thinking about things, is trying to find businesses who continually benefit from higher cycle to cycle margins and returns. And often, as I mentioned, crises like we've just seen lead to severe market dislocations, which is how I'm able to get great franchise businesses on the cheap.
Do you want to just expand on that? Because that's really interesting. Sort of the franchise model is I know an area that you take quite seriously and invest in.
Right. Well, and by franchise, I mean dominant market share producing pricing power at every point in the cycle. You're correct, though. There are a couple of holdings in the fund which are literally franchise models where they own the brand and they franchise out the model. But in this case, what I mean is dominant competitive market share with a significant barrier to entry where it will be difficult for others to challenge the pricing power of the business.
Okay. Now, from there, let's talk about a few of the cyclical themes. So one of the ones that is my favorite to talk to you about is the one that I absolutely cannot pronounce. And I wonder if we just begin there. We're going to look overall sort of at a digital structural theme, but the first one that you know how to say and I don't. Can you go
there? Yeah, no, fair enough. Extreme ultraviolet lithography, or EUV. I apologize. I'm an old semiconductor analyst, so but fair enough. But what's interesting is this is basically the gateway technology to Moore's Law. You know, Moore's Law, of course, is what enables our consumer goods to become smaller, cheaper, and more powerful. It's why Michael Douglas in the movie Wall Street, I don't know if you remember, he was carrying around a big brick of a phone, and now we carry a much more powerful small phone. But anyway, the point of this technology is people have been working on it for almost 20 years. And for many years, they couldn't get it right. They couldn't get it to work. And so a lot of companies did not adequately invest. And the net result is those who did and made it successful essentially have a monopoly in what they do. The entire food chain is a monopoly. So yes, there's ASML, which is the dominant, you know, monopoly provider of EUV equipment, but there's a lot of suppliers as well who also essentially have monopoly providers, monopoly positions, whether they're providing pumps that go into an EUV machine, or they're providing specialty mask blanks, or specialty masks for semiconductors. It's all these competitors just didn't compete. And so ASML wasn't a monopoly 20 years ago, and now they are because their two biggest competitors didn't compete. So I think it is a very interesting theme. There's a follow-on technology called High-NA, so it's sort of a theme where you have 10 years of visibility. And again, I don't want to make forward-looking statements on any given stock, but if you look back at the fund, you'll see a number of names in there. When you start peeling the onion, you realize, oh, they have a significant exposure to EUV.
Let's go with a couple of the other themes, but maybe we can just go through to e-commerce, but really to payments, digital payments. And I mean, I don't spend cash really anymore, but that doesn't mean most parts of the world don't. And therefore, there must be massive opportunities to turn that cash into something else that's digital.
So along with EUV, I mean, digital payments has been a longtime theme of the fund because although it is hard for us to believe because we are mostly digital already, believe it or not, almost half the world's transactions are still done in cash. And even in emerging markets definitely skew that. But even in developed markets like Japan and Germany, cash usage is extremely high. And COVID helped accelerate a trend that was already there. But I think there's a long runway of growth for these companies to benefit from electronic payments. So it's a fascinating trend. And you see it manifest itself in different markets. I mean, of course, Visa and MasterCard are what often people think, and those are valid and actually long-time holdings of the fund as of the last public disclosed data. But then there's other plays like Safaricom in Kenya, where the M-Pesa network actually has been incredibly innovative. It's enabled rural farmers to pay via their cell phones using essentially SMS technology, and now they're upgrading to the next level. So again, not making any comments forward-looking on that company either, but the point is there's a lot of ways to play this general move towards digital payments all over the world. And because the globe, many parts of the globe have been in a severe economic downturn in this past 12 months, you know, payments activity as a whole has gone down, even if there's been a big migration to digital. So you haven't necessarily seen some of these companies grow the way they might have historically in the past 12 months, which to me, you know, smells of opportunity, because I think ultimately economies do come back, people's travel propensities do come back. And I think with that, you'll see an uplift in earnings.
How local do payments companies, I mean, how local can they be? I know they can be global, they can be Visa, yeah, they can be MasterCard, as you say, and, you know, yeah, some companies manage that. But how local, often currencies and smaller transactions are quite a local situation, aren't they? So can you just sort of tease that out a bit?
It varies a lot. I mean, you have global behemoths like Visa, MasterCard. You also have country-specific plays like Safaricom, as I mentioned, which is dominant in Kenya and now hoping to expand into places like Ethiopia. You have other niche networks that will focus on France or Brazil. So actually, there's a lot of interesting plays, some of which are domestic, some of which are international.
Yeah, it's a fascinating area. Let's take a look at some of those. So first of all, your take on the EV market, which we're sort of talking around there, but the idea of electric vehicles are going from here. I mean, there have been some huge moves we've obviously seen, and you've talked a bit about that, but maybe just an expansion on the overall industry.
So yeah, EV, not EUV, just to be clear. Yeah. So there's no doubt that this is a market that's taking off. The challenge is to find companies that fit my investment process that fit this theme. So actually that's been possible. There are some, I often find rather than buy the OEM, meaning the end producer of an electric vehicle, you can often find a consolidated provider of a component that goes into an electric vehicle. And actually, that's where I found better success. So EVs are, you know, definitely an important theme of the fund, not just for the opportunities that they're finding, but also for the implications. What are the implications for traditional auto manufacturers over time? And so you have to be wary of what to avoid as well. You know, companies that you might invest in don't have excessive exposure to, you know, a market that will find growing challenges. You know, what are the implications for the energy market long term? So I think it's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it'd be great to find neat investment opportunities that are consistent with this growth theme. And I've been looking. It's just the challenge is evaluation, and the challenge is making sure that it fits the process that I described earlier. It's possible. You just have to work hard. And then on the flip side, making sure that you are avoiding areas that will be significantly challenged. But there's no doubt it's a long-term growth theme. EVs are certainly here to stay.
You take a look at specific companies that fundamentally fit what you're looking for, and they can be in a variety of different countries. Expand on Japan a bit as a holding. Yeah. Can you talk to that a little bit?
Yeah, Japan's a fascinating market, and there's a lot of very interesting stocks there. I will make a point, which is the most interesting area within the Japan tends to be in more small and mid-cap oriented securities. You know, Japan, just stepping back, has done reasonably well in the last 5 years. But prior to that, since 1990, the market was in a secular downturn. And the result is the number of people looking at the Japanese market has fell precipitously. There's just many fewer analysts looking at it. And the result of that is tremendous inefficiency. And that inefficiency has been most pronounced, in my mind, in the small and mid-caps space. So if you look at the fund's Japan holdings, they tend to be somewhat smaller cap oriented because for two reasons. One, there's more stock level efficiency at the very large caps because those do hit the radar of global funds. But even more importantly, a lot of the big index heavyweights that are large cap tend to be conglomerates or subsidiaries of conglomerates or areas where the ownership incentives of minority shareholders may not be the same as majority shareholders, or these are high cost producers of commodity products. So, or the Japanese banking sector is sort of a whole can of worms in and of itself. So you just have to be careful of painting Japan with one brush. The same comment I made about emerging markets absolutely applies to Japan. So I am excited by a lot of the opportunities I'm finding within Japan, but I'm a lot less excited by the Japanese market as a whole, which is why, ironically, you see Japan has been a solid contributor for the fund over time, and yet the fund has been underweight Japan. and that's because there's a lot of big benchmark holdings I'm not so excited about, but that's offset by some, you know, a number of holdings that I am.
Oh, it's really interesting. It's really interesting insight to sort of how you're balancing out the fund as well. Another question, and I think this is sort of something you don't like to think about, so I'm going to ask you to explain why you don't like to think about it, basically. Do countries trying to drive down their currency, sort of this race to the bottom idea, affect your approach?
So it's not that I don't pay attention to currencies. I pay a lot of attention to currencies. It really ties into my portfolio construction approach. And the bottom line is my focus is on making sure underlying stock picking is the key driver to the fund's performance and not macro exposures. And things like currencies and interest rates, I would count as macro exposures. That's not to say I don't have a view. I may have a view. I just want to make sure that I'm never in a situation where I'm in front of you or anyone else and having to say, gee whiz, you know, I'm sorry, the fund underperformed. You know, I was so bullish on the Brazilian AI, and it turns out it went the wrong way. That should not happen. So I spent a lot of time making sure that the fund's overall currency exposure isn't the most important variable of the fund. Having said that, I certainly pay a lot of attention to different currency moves, and it can have impacts on underlying stocks. So one cannot ignore it. And I'm blessed with the fact that Fidelity has a substantial macro investment team that not only looks at macro factors, but also we have an emerging market debt group that's very focused on emerging market level moves, including currencies. We have a dedicated currency fund, so you know, whose fund manager I've known for many years. So I'm certainly doing a lot of work along these lines, but I do want to make sure that it's not Jed's view of currency that's the key driver of the fund. It really is underlying stock picking.
So on that note, obviously, people are talking a lot about where the US dollar is and actually perhaps where people thought US dollar was going to be, but we have mass amounts of stimulus. We also have the US economy appearing to really pull ahead of others in many parts of the reopening discussion. The inflation story that comes along with the stimulus is in the system and everything else. Again, how do you sort of frame that or frame it and step away from it? How does it fit into your thinking?
Yeah, well, with the caveat I just gave, which is I'm not trying to make a big rates bet one way or the other, I will make a couple of key points. One is which there's no doubt that inflation on a short-term basis is picking up for a number of different commodities. When you talk to companies, I mean, that's a common theme. Energy or lumber or metals or, you know, almost no matter what it is, costs are going up. And many of the companies I'm invested in, because they have the pricing power, are able to raise price in line with that, those cost increases, or even exceeding those cost increases. But you know, to the end consumer, that's inflation. One key question is this durable inflation, or is this temporary inflation that's just a function of the fact that we had a bit of a supply shock from COVID coupled with a reopening, so it takes time for supply to catch up? I think the jury's still out on that. That's really where things lie. The other point I'll make is the company, the stocks, you know, if we think from a stock level, there's been a lot of headlines about very high multiple stocks getting hit with the backup in interest rates that we've seen. You know, they benefited last year when rates went down, and they've been getting hit as rates are going up. And that's quite valid. What I will say is getting back to my initial process, you know, multi-year structural growth, high barriers to entry, attractive valuations. The attractive valuations is what's key and relevant here, because a lot of the, you know, the stocks that are getting hit the most are the ones that maybe aren't generating earnings today, but there's a thought they will generate earnings in 5 years, and there's trading at very high multiples. That tends not to be my investment playground. I tend not to focus on those names anyway. So that has been less of concern for me.
It's very interesting. Can you give us a little bit of a walk? I want to try and fit a couple of questions in here, but let's see. First of all, on sell philosophy, just sort of a note, if you could let investors know how you work through that.
Totally. It's essentially the inverse of, you know, my buy philosophy. You remember my buy philosophy, multi-year structural growth, high barriers to entry, attractive valuations. When one of those three starts to go wrong, then I start to sell the stock. And my favorite one to go wrong, of course, is valuation, because the stock goes up a lot. That means that's good news. You know, typically that doesn't happen all in a day. Typically is going up over time and valuation is getting more expensive. And so I'll be gradually trimming those holdings. Where I tend to be a more aggressive seller is if the high barriers to entry, you know, that competitive moat starts to deteriorate. In those, and the reason why I'm more sensitive there is my valuation framework looks out several years, you know, on a 3 to 5 year sort of cross cycle basis. And the reason I can have that confidence in the earnings power of a company 5 years out is because they have that pricing power. So I can, it's easier to forecast across the cycle. As soon as I begin to doubt their competitive moat, then all of a sudden I don't trust my own 5 year earnings forecast, which means I don't trust my evaluation framework. And so I'm likely to become a more aggressive seller. So it's the converse of my buy discipline, but my behavior will vary depending on which of those three elements is going awry.
Thanks. It's fascinating to sort of hear about the process within. It's a little bit unfair of me to ask a question about ESG with only a minute left, but I'm just going to sort of broadly speaking, clearly the world is working towards discussing this more and more and putting it into action. Does it inform the way you invest in any way?
So it's a great question. It's an increasingly important issue. The answer is yes. I mean, to be clear, this is not a dedicated ESG fund, so I don't want to present it that way. But I will make two points. One is, you know, I'm blessed again with Fidelity has put a lot of resources into ESG, which I think is great because some of the ratings that you're getting from third party providers at the stock level, sometimes it's a function of not digging deep enough, and Fidelity is able to do that. But certainly ESG, from my perspective, is absolutely part of the process. I mean, from a governance perspective, you know, I'm very sensitive of government-owned companies, and as I was mentioning before, companies where the ownership structure incentives are different from that of minority shareholders, so owning related party transactions, et cetera. But from an environment perspective, sorry, I'm going out of order, I guess, on the ESG, but from an environment perspective, you know, I used to run our environment fund, and I'm the son of an environmental lawyer. So I sort of grew up going to a lot of emerging markets and seeing firsthand the negative impact that can happen when, you know, chemical companies or industrial companies are polluting, you know, are polluting the environment, the impact this has on indigenous communities, et cetera. And my general belief is companies that are behaving pro-environment, that ends up being good for business. And same with social, you know, companies that are good for society, that tends to be good for business. And that leads both ways. That means, yes, I'm looking for exciting opportunities within, you know, alternative energy and EVs, et cetera. But it's also the flip side of that. You know, if I think socially, I met a company not long ago that's a human resources company for IT professionals in the UK. And if you just look at the growth and you just look at the valuation, you'd say, okay, this seems like a great stock. But you peel the onion, you start doing a little bit more work, and it turns out they're basically signing university grads up to what one could argue are sort of indentured servitude type contracts. And this is the sort of thing, it hasn't blown up on them yet. Maybe it never will, but it doesn't seem real good for society to me. And I worry it will, you know, this ultimately may turn out to be negative for business too. And so and environment the same way. I mean, there's companies you visit where you can see that they're just not paying attention to the implications of what they do. These are companies that I steer far away from. So absolutely ESG does matter in my investment process.
Jed, it's fascinating to talk to you, and you clearly have such sort of breadth of interest and experience around the world. So thank you for sharing some of those things with us. We'll see you again soon.
No, thanks for the discussion. Very much enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice. And if you like what you're hearing, leave a review or a 5-star rating. You can visit fidelity.ca for more information on future live webcasts, and don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter. Thanks again. See you next time.